Charlie Zimmerman. 5 years ago, massive wildfires burned across Oregon through the first weekend of September. The Labor Day weekend wildfires killed almost a dozen people and destroyed thousands of homes. Many people are still struggling with housing. OPB's April Ehrlich has a story of one family that has finally found some stable ground.
When Rochelle McMaster lived at the Salmon River Mobile Village outside Lincoln City, the traffic from a nearby highway wasn't quite as loud.
There were more trees all along the edge there by the road. There was blackberries and bushes and stuff.
Those trees used to soften the highway noise. But on September 7th, 2020, the Echo Mountain Fire burned them and all but two homes in this park. Rochelle's home was among those destroyed.
It's kind of crazy. I haven't been out here for like 4 years.
Rochelle walks along the gravel road running through the park. To her left is a line of new manufactured homes. They're identical rectangles, like storage containers with sloped roofs, and all are painted black, white, or red. To her right is an empty field.
Like right in here is where my place was.
That's where she used to live with her teenage son and daughter.
Really weird being back out here. It's unrecognizable to me. Even 5 years later, I'm like, yeah, it's still a little hard to come back out.
Before the fire, everyone had brought in their own manufactured homes, so they were all different sizes, shapes, and colors.
This was our community. Now it's all uniform. And I don't like uniform.
Rochelle owned her manufactured home outright and paid about $400 a month to rent the space in the park. But after the fire, the park's owner installed these new units. Now it's charging about $1,800 a month to rent a two-bedroom, two-bath home. Rochelle couldn't afford that on her caretaker's salary. None of the other former residents who lost homes have returned.
No one can afford it. A lot of people are in apartments, like we are.
Five megafires burned across Oregon over the 2020 Labor Day weekend, destroying about 4,000 homes. A quarter of those were manufactured homes, particularly in southern Oregon during the Alameda Fire. Manufactured homes are especially vulnerable to fire. They're not as fire-resistant as stick-built homes, and parks tend to be located along highways or on the outskirts of town, where fire is more common. When parks rebuild after a fire, they often come with newer units and much steeper prices. Many residents struggle to return and lose their old community.
The majority of us are not home. Even though we might have a roof over our heads, it's not home. We're still struggling. We're still trying to recoup from everything that happened to us.
Since the fire, Rochelle has bounced between friends' houses, hotels, and apartments. But that's about to change.
It looks like they did a little bit more than last time I was here.
Now, in a quiet residential neighborhood in Lincoln City, Rochelle walks outside a three-bedroom, two-bath home that will soon be hers. In November, she learned she'd be getting a home through Habitat for Humanity of Lincoln County. All that's left is pouring cement for the sidewalk outside.
I've gotten to go in, and it's beautiful. I'm so excited that we get to move in here soon.
She walks around mounds of dirt and points to a large bay window.
This is one of our favorite things, so it's a nook.
A nook where her daughter can cozy up and read books, something she said she's always wanted.
So this is the master bathroom.
Uh-huh.
And then laundry room. And then
Rochelle continues walking around the home, pointing out her daughter's room, her son's room. She explains how her daughter is going to paint a family tree on one of the walls.
It's going to be kind of nice, you know, having a home that no one else has lived in before, no one else has done things to. So everything will be brand new.
You get it started, it's history.
Yes, I do. And I'm like, this is wonderful.
What Rochelle is looking forward to most is regaining what the Labor Day fires took from her, a sense of stability.
There's no chaos. I'm looking forward to that so much. It's going to be nice to finally have that peace and quiet again.
While Rochelle says she will always live with the grief of losing her former home, her former community, she says she's looking forward to forging this new chapter in her life. I'm April Ehrlich, reporting.
September 2nd marks 80 years since the end of World War II. Northwest Public Broadcasting's Rachel Sun spoke with veterans, families, and a historian working to preserve personal memories of World War II.
I'm in an assisted care home with 96-year-old Beverly Dahman, her daughter Carol, and son Pat. Dahman is sitting in her bed telling me about her older brother, Noel Plowman.
Well, he was a wonderful young man. He was very successful in high school in sports.
Plowman was funny, she says, and a charmer, too.
A lot of girls crazy about him.
Yeah.
He always had a girl.
Growing up in the little town of La Crosse, Washington, Plowman worked harvest during the summer to save for college. He got to Washington State College, now Washington State University, in 1941. But on December 7th of that year, Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. That prompted the United States to enter World War II. Instead of waiting to be drafted, Plowman enlisted in the U.S. Army Air Corps in 1942. He was just 20 years old. From June to September of 1944, Plowman piloted missions in northern France. Then on September 25th, he was assigned a mission intended to target railroad marshaling yards in Frankfurt, Germany. But his plane never returned. For roughly a year, Plowman was listed as missing in action. Dahman says her parents fell into a deep depression.
My parents suffered. At 14, I didn't know how to handle that kind of stuff to help them get over it.
It was a year later when they received the official news. Noel Plowman had been killed in action. Dahman says 80 years later, she still thinks about her brother.
Because you don't talk about it with anybody after this length of time, but you think about it, you know. Yeah. What would it be like if Noel was here and married and had a family?
Alicia Callahan is a historian based in Stanwood, Washington. She specializes in World War II history. Callahan says humanizing wars is an essential part of understanding them.
I think the first step in understanding war for what it is to kind of encourage students to take a step back and understand that those battles couldn't have been fought or even won or lost without each individual that was there.
But getting those stories is hard. Even among those who did make it back, many never talked to their families about the war. Since 2022, Callahan has interviewed roughly 45 World War II veterans about their lives and war experiences. She says depictions of heroic battles and World War II success stories are an important part of American identity. But other stories, the battles that were lost, the realities of warfare, are sometimes overlooked.
Popular media, public memory really just zeroed in on the successes of World War II, and that wasn't the case. A lot of them died because leadership made mistakes. A lot of them made mistakes.
Wally King served as a first lieutenant in the Air Corps. He spoke with Callahan in an interview last year.
Yeah, I think it's parades and fancy uniforms and medals and you name it, but you can't glorify war. It's a dirty, evil, mean business.
Callahan says one of the biggest takeaways for many of the veterans had to do with the way they viewed their enemy. Many said that for years they hated the men they fought, but later on, many saw them in a different light, other young men who had been trying to survive.
Once again, that old tale of old men sending young men to war. They had the blessing of growing older and getting to understand that a bit more.
According to the National World War II Museum, there are over 45,000 surviving World War II veterans in the United States and U.S. territories, less than 0.5% of the 16.4 million who served. I'm Rachel Sun, reporting.
Veteran interviews were provided courtesy of Alicia Callahan. Special thanks to Callahan, Raymond Sun at the Fallen Cougars Project, and the families of service members who were interviewed for this story. You're listening to a feature showcase on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Charlie Zimmerman. The Alameda Fire turned the Bear Creek Greenway between Ashland and Phoenix into a barren, ashy landscape. Recovery has taken a lot of different partners and hundreds of thousands of dollars. Jefferson Public Radio's Roman Battaglia visits the Greenway to look at the process 5 years after the fire.
It's late summer, and the Bear Creek Greenway is buzzing with life. An endless symphony of birds call throughout the landscape. Ducks are searching for food underneath the water, and squirrels dart across the bike path between bushes. But 5 years ago, this place was the opposite of lively.
The way I described it to folks is it looked much like the moon. It was just nothing but gray ash all over the place, just more like a moonscape than anything else.
Steve Lambert is the director of the Road and Parks Department with Jackson County. The Alameda Fire, which started just outside of Ashland, spread quickly through the Greenway, fueled by the endless amounts of invasive blackberry bushes.
There are sections of the Bear Creek Greenway that you literally were bike riding down a tunnel of blackberries.
John Spiess works for the Rogue River Watershed Council, a nonprofit that does restoration projects. The Alameda Fire was devastating. That's not up for debate. It destroyed thousands of homes, and many residents still live with lingering trauma. But Spee says for the Greenway, it was a bit of a blessing.
It was about $1 million of site preparation work that was burned that day. So that was about to get rid of blackberry across 300 acres.
The fire burned those tunnels of blackberries to the ground, leaving essentially a blank canvas for the restoration work that would take place. Spee is standing by part of the creek near Talent. He says they've restored this part to what it was like centuries ago.
Historically, before European settlement, before I-5, this whole valley was like a braided network of beaver dams, very productive coho salmon habitat.
The group removed around 650 dump trucks worth of dirt and material to reopen historical side channels for the creek. A family of ducks floats down the lazy side channel in front of Spee. Restoration work like this brings benefits for lots of species. Dominic Della Sala, a conservation biologist, walks along the same area of the Greenway with his binoculars. He points out all the different kinds of birds he can see along the way, like acorn woodpeckers and warblers.
I wish we were here during the bird nesting season. There's just so much habitat rejuvenation that has been created by this fire. I expect it to be rich with birds for years to come.
JPR brought Della Sala to this area a year after the fire, and he hasn't been back since then. A lot has changed. 10-foot-tall cottonwood saplings have shot up from the ground, and there's a healthy amount of native plants surrounding the bike path. He says that the fire was a natural reset for the Greenway, and from what he's seen, people have taken advantage of that.
It's a really good example of people working with nature during that reset, getting rid of the invasive species, planting some natives in there, to kind of help the system go in the direction that's mutually beneficial.
Still, Della Sala says he'd only give the restoration work a B+. That's because there's still lots of invasive species around. Some blackberry bushes survived the fire, and other troublesome plants like star thistle and cheatgrass have filled in sparse areas. You can't just pull up blackberry bushes once and expect them not to return. They're called invasive for a reason. It requires ongoing work to keep these species at bay. But that's complicated. Jackson County owns some of the land, but so does ODOT, Five Cities, and some private owners. Jackson County's Steve Lambert says vegetation management has become a bigger priority for owners of the Greenway, but they're still working on a plan to pay for it.
Doesn't make much sense for one jurisdiction to manage their tax lots to one level of service and another to a different level of service. Fire will find the path, right?
Lambert says they're currently fleshing out the idea of creating a taxing district for the Greenway to provide long-term funding and a way to manage it cohesively. Ultimately, it would be up to a public vote, but Lambert says that would be a good investment.
We all want a native ecosystem, a native habitat type here that's more fire resistant.
Whether that's worth the upkeep costs will be up to residents. I'm Roman Battaglia in Talent.
Students at Chiloquin Elementary School in Klamath County will have new language options this year. Jefferson Public Radio's Jane Vaughn reports that's because of a partnership with the Klamath tribes.
Students can sign up to take classes in the Klamath, Modoc, and Paiute languages. The tribes and the school have had on and off partnerships for years, including language workshops and assemblies. But this is the first time there will be dedicated full-time classes. Georgine Nelson is the language department director for the Klamath tribes and says she grew up hearing stories from family members about their time in boarding schools.
It was cruel punishment for speaking your Indian language. And so I feel it's important for us to try to get that back into our culture. And I tell people, you know, it's really cool to learn English and Spanish and French, but we were born to speak these languages that we're teaching.
Nelson says a grant from the Bureau of Indian Affairs will allow her to hire 3 more staff members to work at the school. I'm Jane Vaughn reporting.